welcome you to the annual Theodore F. Adams Lectureship on Preaching and the Pastoral Ministry. We have some guests on our campus this week for these lectures and for the pastor's seminar. We especially welcome you to our campus. We are pleased to have all of our guests with us today who come for whatever purpose. We also have some members of the Seminary Women's Club in our midst this morning, and we welcome you. You received a handout as you came in, some notes that you will need for these three lectures, and we would like to request that you bring these notes back with you each day, because the notes have to do not just with today's lecture, but also the other two lectures as well. Our lecture for this series is Thomas H. Troeger, who is a professor at the Iliff School of Theology in Denver, Colorado. You have some data on him in the program. Let me add that he was born and reared in New York State. He is married. He is a professional flutist. And we're going to turn the service over to him at this time. Mr. Troeger.
I'm delighted and very honored to be here this morning. I thought before I gave the lecture we should have time for prayer and a hymn of praise. So let us stand to pray to Almighty God. Let us pray. O guardian of Israel, who never slumbers, never sleeps, we thank you for being awake and watching over us through the hours of the night. We thank you for bringing us safely to this new day, and pray that as morning gilds the skies, we may serve you faithfully in all that we say and do, and join with all of creation in singing your praise. Jesus Christ be praised. Hymn number 221, 221. The lectures for the next 3 days take the form of a fictional narrative about a preaching class. I have deliberately written out full notes, so you won't have to ask me what is the bibliographical reference. Although the narrative is entirely fictional, you will see that many of the students quote various works of theology and things are quoted from history, and those are real. All of those are real quotes. They are in your notes. Now, I'm going to suggest that you put your notes away, because the more important thing is the transaction between us. And later on, you can go back and look at the notes. It also gives you a précis of the action. This is a story. And I want you to join in the story by pretending you're a member of this particular preaching class. Some characters will get you good and angry. Some of them you'll agree with. So if you're sitting there and not having to take notes, you can join in the class as much as possible. Lecture one, or perhaps more accurately, scene one, or act one, is titled Remembered Voices, Recalling the Preachers from Our Past. Peter Linden put down the book he was reading about new methods of preaching. He gazed at the bold print on the wall calendar above his desk. January 2000. 2000. While Peter's eyes traced the round shape of the giant zeros, he remembered a spring term exactly 10 years ago when he had offered an advanced preaching seminar entitled Preachers in Search of Their Voices. And I suppose his classroom was close to a train where he could sometimes hear it going by. The course had looked at the challenges of proclaiming the gospel effectively into the 21st century. What kind of voice would preachers need in an increasingly pluralistic church and society? From all of his years of teaching homiletics, Peter was convinced that every preacher has a voice, a distinctive pattern of substance and expression that can be traced from sermon to sermon. Jeremiah's voice is different from Micah's, Luke's voice is different from Matthew's. Effective preachers keep searching for their true voice, for the way they can most faithfully express the holy vision that impels their witness to God. Peter got out of his office chair with a cracked green leather seat and went to the filing cabinet and fished out the course folder, which was already beginning to yellow with age. At the top of the syllabus was part of an editorial that the Christian Century had published 100 years earlier as the 1890s had drawn to a close. Peter had chosen the quotation in order to remind the class what risky business it is to speak for the future. "We believe that the coming century is to witness greater triumphs in Christianity than any previous century has ever witnessed, and that it is to be more truly Christian than any of its predecessors." Peter's eyes moved from the 1890s quotation back to the new calendar on the wall, January 2000. His mind filled with the televised images of a program he had watched during the last week of 1999. It was a recap of the 20th century. Mustard gas drifting over the fields of World War I. Bodies at Auschwitz. A mushroom cloud. Police dogs attacking black demonstrators. A Vietnamese girl on fire running down the road. The space shuttle exploding. Seagulls covered and choked with oil. Baghdad on fire. That was the century which was supposed to be more truly Christian than any of its predecessors. Peter found a copy of the opening exercise, which he had passed around the seminar table on the first day of class back in 1990. There were three questions. They're in your outline, so you don't have to write them down. One, what is your best memory of a sermon or preacher that had a positive impact on your life? Two, why was this sermon or preacher so effective? Three, what do your answers tell you about finding your voice as a preacher for the 21st century? Catherine Carr had been the first to speak in class. Catherine had taught college English before she felt called to ordained ministry. She had a broad face, pale blue eyes, and wore large dangling earrings that amplified her characteristic gesture of tilting her head to the side when she paused in conversation or during her sermon delivery. She had considered taking a leave of absence because she was pregnant with her first child and she feared the baby, despite the doctor's predictions, might come before classes were over. She insisted that she always be called Catherine and not Kathy or Kate. Catherine began by telling what was going on in her life when she heard the sermon that so powerfully affected her. She had been teaching for 3 years as a graduate student assistant, finishing up her PhD thesis in between grading freshman essays and teaching the seminars that professors did not want. Although raised in a strong church family, she had been president of the youth fellowship in high school, Catherine had not attended church in years, and for one clear reason. Studies in feminist literary criticism had made her so aware of the patriarchy of Christian scripture and worship that she could no longer bear to sing the hymns and offer the prayers and listen to the readings with their incessant recital of male names. Because of her strong church background as a child, Catherine had periodically tried to return to worship, but every time she did, she felt like a daughter raised in a household where the men did all the talking and the women were never listened to. Catherine remembered vividly the events that led up to her hearing of the sermon that changed her life. The Friday before that Sunday, her thesis had been approved, and she had celebrated through the night and into the early hours of Saturday. Then she had gone to bed in the afternoon and slept straight through until Sunday morning. When she climbed out of bed, she was depressed. It was not simply the depression of having overindulged her body on drink and staying up through Friday night, nor could she fully explain it as the depression of having finally to let go of a project that had consumed her energy for many years. Both of these contributed to her state of mind, but they did not in themselves provide a sufficient account of what she was feeling. While she put on the morning coffee, one of her roommates stumbled into the kitchen, inviting Catherine to attend church. Christmas was approaching, and the roommate assured Catherine that the music would be beautiful. Catherine thought that anything, even going to church, would be better than the emptiness she felt that morning. So she threw on what she thought looked like church, and at 10 a.m. found herself entering a sanctuary whose fresh greens and Advent candles reminded her of a childhood on which she thought she had shut and locked the door. There was, to her surprise, a new hymnal in the racks. The discovery of this new book after so many years of absence from worship unbalanced Catherine's soul even more than Friday night's celebration. She had thought that coming to church would be an isolated event, a trip down memory lane to a land she had long left behind, stopping here and there for a fond glimpse and closing her eyes on scenes that were too painful. Her sense of unbalance increased when the preacher who stood in the pulpit to read the gospel and preach the sermon was a woman about her own age, reading from a translation that Catherine had never heard, even though she had been required to take a standard course called the Bible and Literature. "In the beginning, the Word already was," read the preacher from the New Revised Standard Version. "The Word was in God's presence, and what God was, the Word was." At that moment, it began to dawn upon Catherine why she was depressed. Because she had given all of these years to the study of literature, to the interpretation of words, and to the interpretation of the interpretation of words, and to the interpretation of the interpretation of the interpretation of words. Yet always, even at the conclusion of her most brilliant essays that had won the admiration of her professors, she had gone home feeling empty. Now she began to see why. Because in her heart, Catherine hoped that human words would flow from something greater than the private vision of an isolated artist, that words would be an expression of the source of language and being, the Word that was at the beginning. When the woman minister began to preach, she spoke about the Word as being the personification of wisdom, a feminine expression of the divine. For the first time in Catherine's life, she heard a sermon that used feminine pronouns for the Holy One of creation. Tears welled up in her eyes. It was as though she had returned to her childhood home to find a welcome she had not expected. No longer were the men the only center of attention. Her experience as a woman, her belief, her feelings counted as much as the men's. Near the end of the sermon, the woman preacher had quoted from a book by Sandra Schneiders, Women and the Word. Again, this is in your notes. The passage moved Catherine so deeply that the next morning she went directly to the university store to find the book. One of her mentors from the English department saw her prowling through the theology section and trying to be humorous, quipped, "Now that the thesis is over, have you gotten religion?" For a moment, Catherine wondered if she were being a fool. She remembered the grumbling she had heard about the sermon as people left the service. She wondered what kind of support she would find in the church for a faith in Jesus Christ that was rekindled by feminist theology. Now, on that first day of class, Catherine quoted the passage from Sandra Schneider's book, words that she had committed to memory with the same fervor that ancient generations had recited the Apostles' Creed. "We must learn to speak to and about God in the feminine. We must learn to present the religious experience of women as autonomously valid. The therapy of the religious imagination is an affair of language in the broad sense of the term, and it is crucial that we cease to trivialize this issue and begin the long process of conversion from the idolatry of maleness toward the worship of the true God in spirit and in truth." Catherine told her classmates, "Any preacher's voice worth hearing in the 21st century will help to further the therapy of the religious imagination." Catherine saw from their faces that some of the students around the table were struggling with what she had said. Their expressions looked like a blend of incomprehension and resistance. So she offered an illustration of what she meant, observing that as she first entered the seminar room, she had noticed a brass plaque on the outside of the door reading, "This room refurbished through the generous gifts of the Joint Council of Women's Circles of Asbury Church." She had opened the door thinking that perhaps inside there would be a group picture of the women, possibly gathered for some annual meal at their church, or maybe a small copy of their charter, or a photograph of their founding mothers. But instead, Catherine explained as her hand swept toward the walls, I entered to discover these. The interior designers who had recently redecorated the seminar room had supplied more than fresh paint, carpet, and chairs. They had reframed a large number of historic black and white photographs, including shots of the seminary's old campus, dominated by a granite Victorian building which was surrounded by high elm trees. In addition to these larger campus views, there were class pictures going back to the late 1890s. These were still in their original frames. Every senior was surrounded by an oval cutting and a gray matting, so that they were individually set apart, each in his own little cameo. They all looked straight out of the picture with the same serious expression, as if they had put their faces on as carefully as they had tied their black cravats and buttoned the vests on their three-piece Edwardian suits. Underneath every cameo was the student's full name. They were all young white men. Even though the room was handsomely painted and appointed, Catherine found it suffocating. To her, the room seemed a material manifestation of the patriarchal tradition that had crushed her spirit until she heard that transforming sermon. Catherine said that she hoped preachers would prepare the church for the 21st century by taking everything off the walls and starting again. Peter scanned the photographs of the early graduates and imagined all of them looking in horror. They were the past. No one can change history. Then Peter heard Catherine continuing. She would not throw out pictures that were already there, but she would see that they were rearranged and vastly augmented by pictures of the women who had made the room possible. History, Catherine said, is choosing what photographs you're going to look at. This room has too limited a selection. Well, if it's furnishings that you want to move around, let me tell you about the couch in my church at Clyde's Corners, said Jason Kirk. The sound of his voice revealed someone who was skeptical and disturbed by what Catherine had said, but his words indicated he was not yet ready to deal directly with what unsettled him. Jason Kirk was 66 years old. He gave his age when he introduced himself to the class, observing, I guess I'm the oldest one here. Through his 41 years of ordained ministry, he had served 9 different charges, most of them in the country or rural towns. His horn-rimmed glasses matched his neatly trimmed sideburns. He always wore a dark suit to class because he usually combined his hospital calls in the city with his trip to the seminary. There was a sadness in his eyes, as if they had seen so much suffering that the brightest scene would not rekindle their shine. And yet when Jason preached, especially about the healing acts of Jesus, there was a buoyancy in his voice which revealed that hope still lived in his heart. Jason said, To understand me, you've got to picture Clyde's Corners in my church. It's 50 miles south of here. You can take the interstate, but that will only get you within 30 miles. Then you take County Road 17 west, left on Indian Mound Road and right on Preemption Road, and about 5 miles you'll come down a big hill with a lot of alfalfa fields and stone fences to a settlement. There are about 5 houses and a small store with a rusty Coca-Cola sign and a clapboard church with a short-nosed steeple and big stone steps up to a stone porch outside the church's central front door. There's a wooden ramp that comes up to the stone steps from the right-hand side for accessibility. I'd tell you about the debate to get the ramp built, but that's nothing compared to the fight over the red horsehair couch in the chancel. It all started long before I came, said Jason. And then he told how Cedric Clyde, the founder of Clyde's Corners, had become a successful farmer at the turn of the century. To show his thanks to God, he had paid for the building of the local church, the edifice that was still standing there in 1990. Just before Cedric died, he had donated to the church a lot of furniture for the parlor and one item for the raised chancel behind the pulpit, a giant red horsehair couch whose rich color Cedric fancied would brighten the front of the church. The hulking object featured massive curving arms and dark mahogany legs, each carved like the claw of a lion. If some strangers who knew nothing about the faith had entered that sanctuary, they would have concluded that the central religious symbol of Christianity was not the small brass cross on the table, but the humongous couch in the chancel. The couch had occasioned a holy war between the Clyde family clan and some newer families who had moved down to the country to get their children away from the drugs that were spreading into their suburban neighborhoods. The new families had bought up foreclosed farms and built beautiful homes back in the hills. They were accustomed to fine furnishings, and they detested what they had dubbed the Victorian Leviathan, which dominated what otherwise was a plain but handsome church. But the Clydes, whose own farms had fallen on hard times during the Reagan years, looked at the couch each Sunday and fondly remembered that their great-grandfather Sedgwick had founded the church. Although their tractors were rusting in the front yard, at least in the house of prayer, the preacher sat on Sedgwick's couch. "Let me tell you about proclaiming the gospel into the 21st century in Clyde's Corners," said Jason Kirk. "I stand in that pulpit, and over here down to the right," Jason gestured as if he were in the pulpit at that very moment, "sits the Clyde family, all of them. And over here in the middle sit the ones who don't care, and over there, front left, back left, sit the new family. And every sentence I put in the air, I see them all weighing whether it is ammunition for their side or the other side. Here I am preaching about the love of God, and everything I say is filtered through a single question. Is the pastor in favor of the red horsehair couch, or is the pastor against the red horsehair couch? I regret to say that is what preaching toward the 21st century in Clyde's Corners has come to be." By the time Jason Kirk had gotten as far in his story, the jocularity had left his voice, and the sound of his speaking matched the sadness in his eyes. Jason said, "The Clydes talk about our church being at war. That's their word, not mine. I do not like using war as a metaphor. I fought in World War II, and it was what I experienced in battle that opened me to the only hope that has kept me alive since then, my hope in Jesus Christ." Then Jason told how his best friend on the front, his legs blown off by a landmine, had died in Jason's arms. Jason went mad with rage and grief. He ran toward the enemy line, moving entirely by instinct, and rallied his unit to victory. He came home a hero, marching with all the other heroes. But in his dreams, it was not brass bands that played. It was the sound of the landmine going off again and again. "Like Catherine," Jason said, "I too had stopped going to church until I came back one Christmas. I went mostly to please my folks and because I knew there would be more music than talking." Jason's eyes glanced toward Catherine. He looked at her with an understanding that his face had not evinced when she told her story. It was not as though his story was more important than hers. There was not a shred of arrogance in his voice. It was instead as though the memory of his reclaimed faith in Christ had opened him to the truth of Catherine's own experience. Observing the change in Jason, Peter Linden wondered, how can the pulpit awaken this kind of openness to one another in the congregation? One principle began to emerge in Peter's mind. Preaching toward the 21st century would have to make clear the experiences which nurture particular understandings of the gospel. Without this, Catherine and Jason might have been reduced to arguing the merits of their theology as disembodied abstractions. They might have gotten into a vicious fight, while the experiential sources of their passion remained hidden. Catherine, sensing the shift in Jason's tone, was the one who asked, "And Jason, what happened in the church when you went back that Christmas after the war? Why was the sermon so effective?" "Well," said Jason, coming back to his story, "it was a sermon on Isaiah 11, the peaceable kingdom passage about the wolf and the lamb, the one that ends, 'They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea.' I cannot recall the details of what the preacher said, but the memory of the sound of his voice is as clear in my head now as when I first heard it. There was a confidence, a conviction in the voice, an assurance that seemed to have come from some source nothing could ever blow away. God seemed high and mighty and safe, and I wanted to hide myself there. Rock of ages, cleft for me, let me hide myself in thee." Jason finished his story by telling how he loved that passage in Acts 20, which describes the Apostle Paul hastening to be at Jerusalem, if possible, on the day of Pentecost. Jason took the verse to mean that preachers, and indeed the entire church, needed to return to the fire that first warmed their hearts. For Jason, that was the way to find one's voice for preaching into the 21st century. Return to the fire. "Which fire?" asked Dorian White Elk. "Why, the fire of the Spirit, the gift of Pentecost," answered Jason Kirk, as though he could not imagine a preacher not knowing which fire he meant. "But there are many tongues of flame to the one fire," said Dorian White Elk. And from your story, I'm not sure that you warm yourself at the same flame I do. Peter recalled that the class list from the dean's office had included a Dorian White. But in the course of the semester, Dorian revealed that among his people, the Comanche, he was known as White Elk. When his family moved from the reservation, his mother registered him at school as Dorian White because she thought it would make things easier for him. Dorian White Elk was in his early 50s. His soft-spoken voice surprised Peter the first time he heard it, because Peter had expected a much louder sound from this man with broad shoulders and a large barrel torso. Although Dorian was speaking of flame and fire, his voice had none of the passion which Peter usually associated with such imagery. The entire class had to sit very still whenever Dorian spoke, for even in the pulpit, Dorian did not raise his voice. His people did not consider that appropriate for sacred speech. Dorian explained that for preachers to find an effective voice for the 21st century, they would have to listen to the gospel in new ways. Just as his people had listened to the missionaries at the end of the 19th century, now it was time for the white church to listen to the gospel returning to them through a people who heard God in the wind. Peter recalled that before Dorian preached his first sermon in class, he played an Indian wooden flute to prepare them to listen with the intensity that his soft speech required. Sitting in his green leather chair in his office 10 years later, Peter could still faintly hear the plaintive sound of Dorian's flute. The tones drifting through his head clarified Peter's mind, and he could hear Dorian explaining that Jason and he did not warm themselves by the same flame of the Spirit. Dorian's conversation never seemed to head in a straight line to Peter's way of thinking, but he tried to follow it anyway. "I heard every word of your story," Dorian said to Jason, "but I'm not sure you did." "What do you mean? I spoke the words." "Yes, but speaking words is not the same as hearing how they sound to our listeners. When you gave your directions on how to get your church south on the interstate, right on County Road 17, then left on Indian Mound Road, I stopped right there. Indian Mound Road. I kept listening, but all through your story I was thinking, are there Indian mounds south of here? I don't come from this part of the country, so I wondered, are there Indian mounds down toward your church?" "Well, a long time ago there were," said Jason.